Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, certified financial planner and everything you need to know about business. Doug will have the answer for. And this is our show, Mountain Money, and some interesting guests this morning. One on the subject of taxes that we'll all be facing. But first, we're going to talk to Suzanne Mettler, the author of Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotage the American Dream. And Suzanne is a scholar, a professor at a major university. And if you have kids about to go off to college, or kids, period, or just concerned about the state of higher ed, Suzanne has some fairly startling things to say.
And our second guest are actually going to be three folks from the IRS, Bill Brunson, who's the IRS media relations person. We've had Bill on several times, and Bill brought along Tamara Engeloff, who's the IRS taxpayer advocate, which is somebody, if you have questions or need support, Tamara can help you. And then Virginia Keys actually takes the other angle of it. She is the IRS compliance officer. And she's a woman that has a badge and a gun, and if you don't do things you're supposed to do, you do not want her knocking on your door. So it'll be an interesting conversation that was pre-recorded. Larry Warren talked to them earlier this week. Those are going to be our two guests this morning. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment on Mountain Money.
This is Tom Rowney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. And you know, there's a lot of new snow out there this morning. So why don't you plan on going out there about 10 o'clock after a couple of interesting conversations. First up, we want to welcome Suzanne Mettler to the show. She is the Clinton Rossiter Professor of American Institutions at Cornell University and has authored several books about how government works and how it should work. And this one's about how higher education should be working and the politics behind it. Welcome to the program, Suzanne.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Okay. Well, what you your thesis of the book is that American education is in crisis. You know, once and fairly recently, we were the envy of the world, and people the world over sent their kids here to be educated in American universities. They still do. But you say American universities are in a bit of a crisis, and we're no longer the most revered in the world. What's going on?
Well, you know, from the middle of the 20th century, from the creation of the GI Bill for World War II veterans up through Pell Grants in the early 70s, we were managing to take our system of higher education, which was already known for excellence and internationally was already, you know, really at the top, but we managed to make it accessible to more and more Americans across the income spectrum. And Americans really came to think of it as the path to upward mobility, social opportunity. But since that time, we've done less well. And today, we have more and more people going to college than ever, but the outcomes are poor because, in fact, we're reinforcing inequality through the system of higher education today.
In fact, you would argue that one of the villains or one of the participants that has caused this to happen is some of these private universities, for-profit universities, which really gets to the title of the book, Degrees of Inequality, the difference between a good public education or a good private education versus some of the for-profit companies that have great commercials are very enticing, also are very expensive, but you would argue that the outcome for the student is not as good. Is that correct?
Well, yes. And actually, the book casts a broad net, and I really look at ways that the whole system of higher education is reinforcing inequality. But you're right that part of the problem is this growing, emerging sector of for-profit colleges. And these are colleges like the University of Phoenix and Corinthian Colleges and so on, that as recently as the early 1990s, they were just about 1 to 2% of all American college students. Today, it's up to 13%. They take in particularly low-income people and precisely the people that we would really like to see manage to get more education and to have more opportunities. But the problem is that the vast majority of their students borrow, about 94%, and they borrow large amounts because these schools are actually very expensive. The quality of the training they provide is unclear because the problem is that many of these students graduate with $33,000 as their median debt level, and then they're unable to get jobs that enable them to pay back those debts. And so they can end up worse off than if they'd never gone on to college in the first place. And in fact, only 22% even graduate. So many people don't even have the college degree, but they've taken on a lot of debt. So that's really pulling down our system of higher education. These schools use a large amount of federal student aid money today, $1 in $4 that we spend on student aid, and yet they account for almost half of all student loan defaults. And so we're really, American taxpayers are not getting a good return on what we're investing in these schools, and they're leaving many low-income people who had great aspirations worse off than if they'd never attended.
Yeah, Suzanne, your book is about, as you say, a much wider net. But let's stay on this subject of for-profit universities for a little while longer, because I have some familiarity with the subject, having done a lot of reporting on one in particular in Salt Lake City, and just so people understand the depths that not all, but some of these private universities, for-profit universities, will go to. The one I did a lot of reporting on actually went and solicited people outside of blood banks, people who were willing to sell their own blood. They were so poor. And they would sell them on the notion of, you can enroll in college, get a great job, and the government will pay you cash money that you can use any way you want in the form of a Pell Grant. Obviously, the government's intent is that you spend it on your education. But it was quite a scandal, the people who were enrolling were going, wow, I didn't even finish high school, and yet I'm now a college student. I'm going to have a great future. And like you say, instead, they end up with just tremendous debt and not perhaps that good of an education.
Well, it's horrific to hear that kind of a story about that, you know, recruitment happening outside of blood banks. And unfortunately, there have been a lot of stories like that around the country. There are attorneys generals in many states that are now bringing suits forward against these schools because these kinds of stories have been coming out. And so it's a real travesty that you have people who, you know, put their confidence in this sort of American dream that is so widespread in the United States that if you work hard and you get more education, you're going to be better off. And these schools take advantage of that that aspiration that people have and the fact that government money is subsidizing them. These schools are allowed by law to receive up to 90% of their revenues from the federal government and actually from just one public policy, from the Higher Education Act's Title IV, which is student loans and Pell Grants. And that doesn't even count what they can get over and above the 90% from the GI Bill and from other Department of Defense education programs. So, you know, you have the largest of these schools, which you know, in the 1990s, many of them became multi-state enterprises, and they're publicly traded on Wall Street, the biggest of them being the University of Phoenix. And they really began to make these much bigger profits and to recruit very heavily. They, unlike traditional colleges, they spend a great deal of their funds on recruitment, doing just the kind of thing that you were describing, of going after students and encouraging them to sign up and to take out student loans. And then, as far as we can tell, their commitment beyond that to students is not so great. It's not so clear what's really happening in the classroom and the training that they provide. So that, you know, here you have American taxpayers really subsidizing these, well, they're called private sector colleges, but if they're getting, you know, something like at 86% on average of their revenues comes from government for the top 15 or so, that hardly looks like a private sector organization. And then they have such poor outcomes for students that it's a huge problem.
Yeah, those are good points. And just as a reminder for our audience, just be careful when a college, you know, sometimes for juniors and seniors, they'll get a lot of material from various universities trying to recruit them. And sometimes that's a great thing. But other times, you know, you're just a customer. You're just a client to a corporation, which in this case is a university. So don't be misled. I've heard young people say, well, I'm going to go to this college because they really wanted me. And sometimes that's a good thing. But sometimes it's just you're part of their mailing campaign and it wasn't that they wanted you at all. And you might be much better served to go to another university that is higher ranked. So just be careful. I remember when I was a kid, I got some materials and I initially thought that way until somebody warned me about that. So that's, we're at that point in the school year, Larry, where seniors are graduating and thinking about where they want to go. So be careful. Suzanne, I want to take you back to the opening of your book. One of the major themes in your book is really this is one of the few areas that our politicians agree on, which is supporting public education, which ironically that bipartisan support has contributed to the problem. And you open your book with a session of Congress that takes place in February of 2011. Tell us what was going on there and whether that had any impact.
Well, the Obama administration has been trying to create new regulations to try to rein in the for-profits so that those which are the very worst actors will, after 3 years of, you know, of a bad performance, will not qualify for federal student aid. But when they were in the midst of this rulemaking process in 2010, 2011, there were various votes in the House of Representatives and Congress that were standing up for the industry and saying to the Obama administration, you should not be forcing these regulations down their throats. And what was so interesting, we are in an era when the U.S. Congress is more polarized by political party than at any point in modern history. So Democrats and Republicans agree on almost nothing. We have stalemate around most issues that the American public would like to see action on. But here's an issue where you had bipartisan agreement. All Republicans were in favor of this this bill that was going to be, you know, saying to the administration, please don't regulate the for-profits. And they managed to get something like 60 votes from Democrats to vote with them. So you had liberal Democrats voting together with Tea Party Republicans. That's really striking. And so what I found is a general pattern in this policy area today. Most of the reason why federal government has been letting our system of higher education turn into one that's reinforcing inequality, most of that comes out of the stalemate that emanates from partisan polarization. But some of it happens when you have votes like this, where powerful vested interests, like the for-profit colleges, manage to get their voices heard above the din of party politics and manage to get a majority from both parties supporting them.
Now, let's Suzanne, move on to public universities. And there you say inequality is being driven just by the fact that public universities have become so gosh darn expensive, and the average debt per borrower is like $22,000 at a public university now. I don't know if that's is that per year or per 4-year degree.
That's for the 4-year degree.
Okay, yeah. And that kind of debt load alone discourages lower income people from finishing all 4 years and getting a degree. So they're winding up because of the cost dropping out, not finishing, or taking 6 years to finish, and that alone puts one socioeconomic class, those who can afford that kind of debt, in a better position than those who cannot.
Well, since we've been talking about the for-profits, first I want to segue from that to the public. It is often the case that a student can get training in the same field at a public university or college, often a community college, that they could get at a for-profit, and they can get it for a much lower price. And without going into the kind of debt they would at a for-profit. So first of all, what must be said about the public universities and colleges, and I'm going to talk about their cost increases, but they are still the best bargain around when it comes to higher education. They charge far less tuition than either the for-profits or the non-profit traditional private universities and colleges. So they're a good deal. Now, that being said, their tuition has been going up by a very great percentage, and that's a real problem given that 73% of American college students attend this sector, and it includes lots of middle-income people and some low-income people. The increases at the publics, while still they're cheaper than the other sectors, these increases can make the difference for many students between enrolling in the first place and not enrolling, and once they're enrolled, staying and graduating or not. Because the average state has dropped their spending per student since from 1990 to 2010, it dropped by 26%. And so what the colleges and universities have done in response is to charge more of the students, charge more in tuition. And so tuition has gone up over that same period by 113%. The other thing that the colleges and universities do to cut costs is they have to squeeze resources. So they are squeezing more students into the classroom. So the ratio of students per faculty member is getting much larger. They're also turning increasingly to online courses, which, there's a lot of talk about online education being this exciting and innovative new thing, but we don't know much about what it means for learning outcomes, and the little evidence we have suggests that for students who come from less advantaged backgrounds, they are not well served by these online courses where they don't have the same kind of interaction with faculty members they would otherwise. But public universities and colleges are increasingly turning to online education as a cost savings measure. And they're also having to scale back on all kinds of student services that help students to manage to get to graduation day. So for all of these reasons, when it comes to, how can we really get higher education back on track so that it is that path to social mobility, reinvesting in the public universities and colleges is a top priority.
Okay, well, let's hope that happens in this political atmosphere, as you described it, of course, and we've heard so many others describe it the same way. Let's hope somehow that happens anyway. Thanks very much for joining us, Suzanne Mettler, author of Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Ed Sabotage the American Dream. Thanks very much for joining us. Lots of food for thought in here, and we, of course, only scratched the surface. But thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Suzanne.
And our forecast is for snow likely later today. Tonight, about a 60% chance. Tuesday, about a 70% chance. And actually, there's a chance of snow all through Friday of this week. So it's not over yet. We still have a
couple. Don't put away your skis or snowboard yet.
Yeah, I mean, the best may be yet to come. I remember last year, I think my last day of skiing was a powder day, as I remember. So we will be back in just a minute, and we're going to talk, if you haven't filed your returns yet, or even if you have, an interesting discussion with the IRS after this.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Dana Edwards on behalf of Vail Resorts and Cannons Resort, supporting KPCW. This year, we developed partnerships with 25 local nonprofits to support programs like the fourth grade program at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. Every fourth grader in Summit County will experience Utah's ecosystem firsthand and see science come to life through infield classes. Thanks to Swanner for making science cool.
Of the Internal Revenue Service with us this morning to answer questions you may have about how to fill out a return, what help is available, and what happens if things go south for you in terms of filing your return. So we have with us Bill Brunson, who's kind of a semi-regular on Mountain Money in person. He's works out of Phoenix for the IRS as a spokesman. We also have a taxpayer advocate who works within the Internal Revenue Service representing taxpayers. Tamara Angeloff is with us this morning. She offices in Salt Lake City, as does Virginia Keyes, who is a special agent of the Department of Treasury Internal Revenue Service, and she knows all about what tax scams are out there and what to do if you're in trouble and how people get in trouble. So, Bill Brunson, let's start with you. There is a lot to cover, and we'll start with some general questions like who really needs to file a return? Is there a certain income threshold at which you don't need to even bother?
Well, Larry, first off, thanks for having us on.
Sure.
The Internal Revenue Service is always happy to be on public radio. As far as filing requirements for the 2013 tax year, let's say that you're a single individual under 65 and your income is $10,000 or more, you have a filing requirement. So it depends upon your income and your marital status. Married couples filing jointly, both spouses under 65, then that figure is $20,000. But let's say that you're an independent contractor and you're talking about net income, what you keep in your pocket. If you have net income of $400 or more, you have a filing requirement. If you sell a home, you have a filing requirement. If you take a premature distribution from a pension fund, you have a filing requirement. So there's information on filing statuses and who needs to file on IRS.gov where people can follow that algorithm or see the indicators in a chart form. So that's kind of a general overall who needs to file. But then there's folks that want to file. So let's say that you were a student, your folks can claim you on your tax return, and you worked over the summer, earned a little bit of money. Well, that federal income tax, that little bit of money that you earned, you can probably get all that refunded to you. So those sorts of circumstances where you have paid federal income tax but haven't met that threshold of filing return, the requirement for, then you would want to file to get your money back.
And, in fact, there's a lot of people who haven't filed, and you're holding funds in the millions, really, for Utah folks who have not filed and maybe ought to get a little money in their pocket.
The IRS receives information from third parties, primarily Social Security. And when we crunch a few numbers, and we're seeing that there are about 6,100 Utahns who, if they file for 2010, would receive a refund. So people need to think, gee, did I file for 2010? If you don't have a copy, you can ask the IRS. But if you didn't and you want to get a refund, as in you've got one coming, but you need to file a return, then you need to do so before Tuesday, April 15th. If you don't, the time frame runs out, and then that ability to claim that refund for 2010 is gone. So the IRS is looking at $4.7 million for approximately 6,100 Utahns with an average or median refund of $518. So if you haven't filed for 2010, you can go online to irs.gov, get those prior year forms and instruction booklets. We have publications, too, for that particular time period. If you need W-2s or 1099s, as long as they've been reported to the IRS, those information returns, we can provide that information to you. But if you wait until that last moment, you're not going to be able to get all those resources together to file for 2010.
Yeah, so now is the time. And that brings up one of the two IRS junk mails that were in my – not from IRS, mind you.
Right.
But two junk mails I received just this morning when I opened my email box. And one said, the IRS owes you money. Contact us now to get your money back. This is the kind of money you're talking about, I presume.
It could be. You would have to contact those folks.
And those are third-party people who are out to get a percentage of the – of the money that's owed, but they don't need that third party, do they?
No, you can do it yourself, folks. You don't need to pay somebody to do that sort of an item because we're going to provide you with all the information. And then if you have questions about the return, you can either go online to find those answers or you can call us on our toll-free line, 1-800-829-1040, 1-800-829-1040, Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. local time. But if you receive an unsolicited email, like you just did, Larry, that asks you for personal or financial information or is saying that it is from the Internal Revenue Service and it's unsolicited, then you may have a phishing scam and you would want to beware. The Internal Revenue Service already has personal information, so why are we going to ask for it? As far as financial information goes, we can contact your bank or credit union and get that. So you want to be wary of what comes in that inbox and how you respond to it. So my suggestion would be don't open that link. Don't click on that attachment.
Okay. And Virginia Keys, you see this all the time as a special agent for IRS. What are some of the common tax scams out there that people need to watch out for? Because I had two this morning. Saying well, and the other one was saying that if you owe the IRS, we can negotiate it the amount owing down for you, and we'll get into that with Tamara in just a moment. But let's talk about some of the IRS scams that are out there, the kinds of things I got probably hit with this morning.
Well, I'm so glad you asked. In fact, we do see it quite a bit. The two biggest ones that we've seen especially are identity theft, which is now the number one priority of the IRS and IRS criminal investigation and investigating those issues. The second one is phone scams that we've seen, especially in the Valley here in Salt Lake and the surrounding areas. And one thing that I would definitely say to your listeners is go on to IRS.gov, and we have what we call the Dirty Dozen tax scams for 2014. And these are tax scams that we've seen nationwide and in the area that taxpayers can familiarize themselves with so that they hopefully will not become victims of those scams. With identity theft especially, one of the things that they need to do is try to protect their own identity. It's one thing when it's stolen through no fault of their own, and that's horrible, and we recognize that. When identity is stolen, period, it's horrible when it's used badly. But taxpayers can do a number of things to keep themselves safe and their identity safe. The biggest one that I would also say is don't carry your Social Security card with you ever. Don't put it in your wallet. Don't put it in your purse, because if you get that stolen, that's a golden ticket for any kind of thief to be able to open false credit in your name, but especially file a false tax return.
And I would probably think it's good advice just to be skeptical of anyone who calls and says they are with the IRS and then asks you questions, because that's not really how you communicate with clients.
That's absolutely right. In fact, for phone scams, if you get a phone call that says, "We're from the IRS," they may have a badge number. They may sound official. And unfortunately, on your caller ID, it may show up as the IRS because that thief has spammed and spoofed the number. And when they call and they say, "Hey, we're from the IRS," you owe us money, you need to give us either your personal information or you need to give us some money right now or you will possibly be arrested.
Or they'll say, give us your credit card number and we can settle this debt right now.
That's right. That's not the IRS. That's not true. In fact, some of the thieves have even gone so far to tell immigrants, these victims, that they're going to be deported if they don't pay money right now. And those calls are simply not from the IRS. Those are thieves. The IRS doesn't contact taxpayers that way. In fact, if you have a problem with your tax returns, what will happen is the IRS will send you a letter. That letter will have a specific employee at the IRS as well as their contact phone number that that taxpayer can call. And if the taxpayer gets the letter and they're still a little concerned about it and not sure if it's really from the IRS, they can always go on to irs.gov and get the 1-800 number. I believe Bill said it earlier. It's
1-800-829-1040, 1-800-829-1040.
Exactly. And they can take that letter and call that the IRS number and just ask, is this a real employee of the IRS? Is this legitimate? And have that confirmed. So I would definitely say when you get those phone calls and you're just not sure, do not give them any personal information whatsoever. And don't give them any of your credit card or other information either, because those are not from the IRS.
Sure. Now, the IRS does work with taxpayers, however, and this is where Tamara Angeloff comes in as the local taxpayer advocate. What's your role within the advocate within the IRS? You're kind of the consumer advocate, taking the consumer's not side, but taking their concerns over and above just the filing of returns.
That's correct, Larry. And to speak of the email that you received this morning, that we may be able to solve your debt at for much less, that very well could be a legitimate CPA firm. And what they're generally referring to is an offer and compromise. And our office, if you're not able to go online and complete those forms yourself, our office can provide the education and the knowledge that you could actually compute what the offer amount that you could afford to pay or structure the offer. And our office is always happy to do that. We are a free service. We are a little bit different than the IRS because we do report to Congress rather than the IRS commissioner. And we do assist taxpayers who are experiencing an extreme hardship or systemic delays where they just, whatever they do, and this is could be a taxpayer or a CPA, a taxpayer, an attorney, where we would actually help them navigate through the system and cut the red tape.
And you see these ads on late night TV from attorneys and CPA firms saying, we will help you reduce your debt. You're saying you will also help you reduce your debt if you owe. But I would think that somebody out there who owes a bundle to the IRS would think, well, yeah, they say they'll negotiate, but I need a lawyer in a fancy suit to get a better deal.
Well, you know, and that's not true. We do have a staff of attorneys, and we are very educated. My staff is extremely educated, and we have subject matter experts when there's a gray area in the Internal Revenue Code. We do also have to work within the preview of the Internal Revenue Code. We're very good at what we do in the Taxpayer Advocate's Office, and so we have a very high success rate on getting offers accepted, either through the normal processes or through the appeals process. The one thing that I tell taxpayers when they come to me, when they're considering going out and getting an attorney or a CPA, some of them are outstanding and they do just as good a job, if not, you know, just as good a job as we do. if you can afford to pay that $7,500 to the attorney, I would definitely consider increasing your offer by $7,500 and getting the chances of that offer getting approved. So that's just something that you really need to consider. Where is the best place to put that money? It's generally with the IRS.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the basics, Bill Brunson, and just talk about what common mistakes kick a return out for further review or further having it returned to the sender with instructions to fill it out more thoroughly.
Well, Larry, earlier we were talking a little bit about this, and you mentioned a a common item, which is a math error. We'll get to what you mentioned in just a second, folks. So if you make a addition or subtraction error, math errors are going to be one of those common problems. You mentioned forgetting to sign the return. And this is especially true for married couples filing jointly, where both spouses need to sign that return. Another item is an individual will claim a child on the return. They'll put the person's name down there, but they won't put the Social Security number of the child down. So they'll leave off the tax identification number for that dependent. Another item, they'll forget to claim all of their income. So if you went to the casino, those gambling winnings are taxable. If you receive tips, put them on the return. And then filing status errors. There are definitions based on various items where you would say, I'm filing married filing jointly or married filing separately. Well, head of household seems to be one where a single individual owns a house and thinks for tax purposes they are head of household. Well, there are other factors involved. So you want to make sure that you fit the criteria, the definition of that item. But the way to avoid all these is to electronically file your tax return, and you won't have these common problems.
It won't let you file a return if you did the math wrong.
It won't let you do the math wrong.
It's got a calculator in it. Yeah.
It'll make sure that you have a number for everybody that you're naming on the return. It'll make sure that you have all the supportive documents that you need for the items that you're claiming on the various schedules. So it's almost error-free. Less than 0.5% is the error rate for an electronically filed tax return compared to a paper return, which is around 13%. And then if you file electronically, chances are you won't get one of those letters in the mail from the IRS after April 15th.
And if you file electronically, does that speed the process? Are you, if you have a refund coming, you're going to get a refund quicker?
8 weeks for a paper return with a paper check, about 21 days if you electronically file and have a refund coming where that money can be directly deposited in your savings or checking account. And as opposed to the old paper check, that direct deposit, the money can't get lost or stolen or returned as undeliverable. So if you are going to file a return, whether it's paper or electronic, and you're going to get a refund, choose direct deposit, and then you won't have to worry about that money going in your savings or checking account.
Okay. Virginia, as a special agent, maybe this is a question you don't want to answer, but a lot of people, accountants and people kind of on the periphery not in the IRS, but people who deal with the IRS say things like, oh, don't take a home office deduction. Home offices trigger audits. That's something that's going to trigger an audit. Are there things that are looked at more hard than others when it comes to deductions?
You know, that's actually not in the purview of criminal investigation necessarily. That's more of a regular IRS revenue agent question. So I'll pass that one to Bill.
Okay, Bill gets that one.
With the filing of your return electronically, you're going to eliminate a lot of those items. But let's say that you don't have a lot of accounting sense and you're doing your own return. So you may expense something that you should capitalize, carry on the books. That could trigger an audit where you're writing something off in the year that you bought it, as opposed to taking a portion of it each year over a number of years.
Like a business expense the product's going to last, a copy machine, it's going to last you 5 years or
something. Exactly. You have to take 1/5 of the value of that machine that you paid for over 5 years. That's depreciation. So those sorts of things where if you're not following generally acceptable accounting procedures, then that could trigger an audit. But more so, it's where something is out of a statistical norm. So if you're in the business of, say, a gas station, there are certain products and items that you're going to buy that are associated with that business. But if we start seeing costs and expenses that have nothing to do with running a gas station, that could, say, trigger an audit. So items that fall out of a statistical norm, a bell curve, where that would raise a red flag. They use quadratic formulas to check the accuracy of returns, and then they also look at things on the return based with what it is that you're claiming and how they match up. So there's a lot of different things going on here, but less than 1% of the population is actually audited.
Very good. Now let's move on to also the subject of choosing tax preparers? If all of this is just too complicated, how do you know who to hire?
65% of all Americans will go to a paid preparer, which equates to 65% of all Utahns. And Virginia and I can address the situation, and I'll take the first shot, and then she can finish up. The taxpayer should choose wisely, because a bad tax preparer can hurt them. So choose one as if you're choosing a physician or a dentist for your family. You can check with the Better Business Bureau to see if that person or that business is in good standing. Your good tax preparer will have a PTIN, Preparer Tax Identification Number, issued to them by the Internal Revenue Service on an annual basis that they will willingly place on the return that they are filing for you, as well as sign the return as a paid preparer and provide you with a copy. So those things should happen up front immediately. Your good tax preparer is going to ask you a gazillion questions so that they can take advantage of the current tax code and provide you benefit for all the allowances and credits and deductions that are there for you. Your good tax preparer is going to want to see all sorts of receipts as well to back up what they're claiming on the return. It's called due diligence in essence. So if the person that you're dealing with doesn't start showing those characteristics, you might wonder a little bit about it. A bad tax preparer will say up front, without running any numbers through the form, you're going to get a refund and it's going to be a big one. Well, how would they know if they haven't crunched any numbers? They don't know whether you're going to owe or you're going to get a refund. Your bad tax preparer will say, you know what I'm going to charge you is only going to be based on a percentage of the refund that I get back for you. Well, that is not a good thing because it lends itself to the tax preparer padding expenses.
Yeah. Now, Virginia, if you have one of the not so good tax repairers, can you blame them for a wrong return, or it's really ultimately you who's signing it?
You know, you can try to blame them,
but it won't get you very far.
But you know, all taxpayers sign their return, and those signatures are put there under the penalty of perjury, which means that the ultimate responsibility is the taxpayers to make sure that those returns are correct and that the numbers look right. And just like Bill said, I think one of the big things is to make sure that as a taxpayer, you are getting a copy of your return, you're able to review it, and that you're signing it, your tax preparer is signing it, and that you have a copy. Now, that doesn't mean that a tax return preparer won't pad the numbers after you got a copy of the correct return. They may very well pad the numbers and send that in to the IRS anyway. But what you'll be able to show is that you have the correct return, which then puts our focus on the fraudulent tax preparer. And we see those cases. We do have those cases of return preparer fraud that do come into our office. And one thing that I would also caution tax return preparers is, for the most part, I would say most of them are honest. They do their best to try to put forward an honest return. But the ones who are not, the IRS criminal investigation is aware of you, and we are looking for you. And the fact of the matter is when we find you, you will be in hot water, and there's a good chance that you will see prison time if you are preparing false returns.
Okay, you heard it here. Take that warning seriously. But if you have questions, let's go back to Virginia for one more comment.
I was just going to add also, we do have IRS undercover agents, and so tax return preparers do need to be aware that we do have undercover special agents.
Oh, they'll be going in with their tax information and quizzing them on what they can do for you.
We do. And if a tax return preparer chooses to file a false return for our undercover agent, again, they'll find themselves in some hot water. So they never know. A tax return preparer may be trying to prepare a return for one of our criminal investigation special undercover agents.
Okay, we need to wrap this up, but give us some numbers and websites where if you have last-minute tax questions, and you can go to if you want to research it on the web or talk to someone in person.
Larry, the best place to go for any taxpayer is irs.gov. You can download forms. You can file online electronically for free. You can get answers to your tax questions. There's just a whole host of a variety of tax items. Then the second best, I would say, would be to call us by phone, 1-800-829-1040, 1-800-829-1040, Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. local time. And then we do have offices throughout the state. There's a walk-in office in Provo where we have taxpayers come in. But you want to check first to see what the time frames that that office is open in Provo before you go there, in case they're closed for lunch or somebody had to go and do something in the afternoon. And then there's an office in Salt Lake at 50 South 200 East. Same thing. Check and see if the office is open before you go. But that's a bigger office up in Salt Lake, and they're open basically Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 4:30.
And at the very least, you haven't gotten your return started yet, at a very minimum, you need to file an extension.
Yes.
That's correct. And that can be as simple as going to irs.gov, clicking on the free file icon, and selecting that particular item that you're requesting an extension. But the key here is, folks, you have to do it before midnight Tuesday, April 15th, for that additional 6 months to file the return, not to submit the taxes. So everybody can get an extension. They don't have to pay any money. It's free. But you have to do it in a timely manner, and it'll give you an additional 6 months to file your return through October 15th.
Okay, good information. Thanks for joining us. And one last comment from Virginia Keyes, special agent with the IRS.
I would also add that if you have been or think you are a victim of identity theft, we have a specialized unit called the IRS Identity Protection Specialized Unit, and you can reach them at 800-908-4490, extension 245. And so if you need any help, you can either go onto irs.gov, look up the identity theft issue, or call them again at 800-908-4490, extension 245.
Very fine. Thanks for joining us, Bill, Tamara, and Virginia from the Internal Revenue Service. The deadline's coming up.
Thank you.
Get yourself filed.
Thank you very much.
This is Ryan Hall, Bridge Manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, Commercial Lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is Matt Mitten, attorney with Jones Waldo, a Park City law firm. Longtime supporters of KPCW, our firm provides estate planning and other personal legal services to residents of Summit County and beyond. We are online at joneswaldo.com and 435-200-0085.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. Hope you're now informed about what to do and, of course, what not to do in terms of what you put on your IRS 1040 form, which is due now in a little more than 2 weeks. And Doug Wells is, in addition to being a great co-host and a board member of KPCW, actually, is associated as a partner at Albion Financial. And Doug, often go to you for financial advice, but in a general way, I'd like to pick your brain on a few things. We have the time today, and I pulled out of Forbes magazine not too long ago their 2014 investment guide, and they had, I don't know, a couple hundred tips about...
That's a lot of tips.
That's a lot of tips, and I'm sure you disagree with many of them, but I just wanted to highlight some of their tips that I think are wise advice, and then get your opinion on what Forbes says you ought to be thinking about in 2014, or really any year. So one of their little tidbits says, remember Enron, reduce your employer's company stock in your 401k. Good advice, obviously, for the Enron people.
Yeah, I think it's definitely good advice. And unfortunately, every several years, we have to be reminded of it. Enron was a good example. Unfortunately, there's examples from time to time that come up. But yeah, you don't want to have too much risk in one company, especially if it is your employer.
Yeah, if it's your job, that's already risky. You know, your job could end. And then if your stock is also entirely in that company's
stock.
Yeah,
success in investing is really a long-term approach as opposed to get rich quick. And when that works well, it works really well. But when it goes bad, things can really go upside down very quickly.
And that points out another one of their tips, which is straight from Warren Buffett, a quote of his, diversification is protection against ignorance.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. We believe in diversifying. That said, it's easy to be over-diversified. You know, you probably, in my opinion, if you have 20 to at most 100 stocks, you know, 20 to 40 is probably a good range. And with mutual funds, be careful because you probably in each mutual fund have 100 stocks. So do you need 20 different mutual funds in your portfolio? Probably not.
By definition, a mutual fund is going to be diversified, although it could be a sector fund where it's all concentrating on something.
It can
like
be, which brings up another point, which is know what you own, right? When you own a mutual fund, understand what that mutual fund does, what its goal is.
Okay. Been a lot of talk about Bitcoin lately. Another piece of their sage advice is buy Bitcoin as a speculation or a political statement, not as a hedge.
Yeah, you know, I'd even go further than that. The IRS just ruled last week that Bitcoin is considered a property, not a currency. And what that means is every time you buy or sell something with Bitcoins, you have to technically you have to report capital gains on that. It's just too complicated for most folks.
So stay away from it. I think probably so. Good advice for the average investor. How's this one? Excuse me. Build an emergency fund outside of your 401k. Don't have all your eggs in that basket, I guess.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And you know what? You should have 6 months, in my opinion, 6 months of living expenses in a cash account at a bank down the street. It's painful. You're going to get no interest on it. But really what you get is sleep at night factor. It gives you freedom and flexibility as well.
So even without tapping the penalty-laden 401ks and IRAs, you know you're going to get through half a year.
Exactly.
Okay. Here's one I'm guilty of. Write down your passwords and hide them and tell one person where they are, presumably your mother or spouse.
You know, that's
if you're getting along with your spouse.
That's a funny one. I'm guilty of that as well, Larry. I tend to have just a couple of passwords, which I know people suggest that you don't do. That said, I'm not a fan of writing down a password. It kind of defeats the purpose of having those passwords. If somebody were to break into your house and find that list, it would give them a lot of power over your accounts.
Indeed. Don't abdicate, speaking of spouses, don't abdicate investment decisions to your spouse. Should both participate equally?
You know, I don't know about equally, but both should have a voice, and your investment strategy should be considerate of what both of your outlooks are. It's not unusual to have one spouse that's much more aggressive, willing to be aggressive in investments, and another one that's more conservative. And probably for you to stay the course in good times and bad times, the answer is somewhere between those two strategies.
Okay. And, you know, a lot of people were tempted by low interest rates. Another piece of advice from Forbes is never take on a mortgage just so you get that tax deduction.
You know, there's something to be said for not having a mortgage. It's a great piece of sleep at night comfort. If you're fortunate enough not to have a mortgage, I would think very carefully before you take one up just because it's quote unquote cheap money.
Okay, well, let's talk about next week's show. We've got a really great guest. Hope you can stay with us for next week's show. Haunted Empire, Apple After Steve Jobs. And this is by a Wall Street Journal reporter who was the beat reporter for Apple. And you're very high on this book.
Yeah, I actually ordered it before it came out. This is a woman that really knows Apple, and it's an important question for investors, particularly those that own Apple stock or are fans of their gadgets, which is, what does Apple look like after Steve Jobs? Is there a team? Is there another Steve Jobs behind them? Or are there creative days behind Apple? I think they still have a lot of creativity in front of them, a lot of innovation. That said, this is a really important year for them. They have to prove it. And Yukari Kane, a very well-respected ex-Wall Street Journal reporter, very controversial book. I'm really impressed that Beth Fratkin, our producer, was able to line her up for us to speak to next week.
So stay tuned for next week's show, and we will talk about the most talked about business book of 2014. And coming up tomorrow on This Green Earth, Nell and Chris will be speaking with Jake Powell, who's the watershed coordinator with the Camas Conservation District. Learn what roles conservation districts play in protecting soil, water, and natural resources all around us. Always a good environmental conversation on This Green Earth. And I want to thank our great sponsors, the Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, Prudential Real Estate, San Francisco Design, and we want to welcome Jones Waldo Holbrook and McDonough. Jones Waldo for short, a great law firm in Salt Lake, and they have a large practice group in Park City. They have joined us as a sponsor of Mountain Money, and we thank them for that. Any final words of wisdom, Doug?
Final words of wisdom. No, I like going through that short list, and you've heard me say it before, but really it's about having a long-term investment strategy. You and I have talked about what's going on in the market periodically this quarter. Ironically, for all the ups and downs, you know what? The market's finishing the first quarter of the year pretty much where it started the first quarter of the year. So it's really a long-term, stay the course, know your strategy.
Okay, very fine. Thanks for joining us on Mountain Money. We have snow in the forecast, 60% chance tonight, 70% chance tomorrow yet. So still, good ski days ahead. This is KPCW Park City.